Okay, thanks for attending. Seems as though the issue of budging is more popular than we thought we planned for. My name's Adam Oliver. I'm based in the social policy department here. I kind of trained as a behavioural economist, really, so I've done a lot of work on behavioural economics over the years. And as we'll see, as I hopefully will explain as we go through this, nudge policy is fundamentally influenced and informed by behavioural economics. This is a really strange room, this, because I'm just assuming that you've got the same thing. So what I'm going to talk about a little bit is what I think the nudge approach entails, which will probably engender a lot of disagreement within the room, because it seems to have become a very loose area, really, a loosely defined area. So I'm going to talk a little bit about what I think a nudge is. I'm going to talk a little bit about what I think behavioural economics is, which fundamentally informs nudge policy. I'm going to talk a little bit about what I think are some of the problems with the nudge approach, and I'm going to offer kind of an alternative behavioural economic informed policy direction. So that's my plan, right? I feel really sorry for you there standing in the corner. It's like being in the football terraces, isn't it? You throw two peas at me in a minute or something like that. So I'm going to talk about those things. If you want to interrupt me as I go along, that's fine. You know, just do so, because I've only got 8 slides here, so I'm sort of relying on you interrupting me to some extent. Okay, so this is the title, From Nudging to Budging. Okay, so over the last, 10, 12 years, something like that, a lot of behavioural economists have been developing philosophical frameworks for their for various approaches that they're putting forward, that they're promoting. And most of these frameworks are kind of soft forms of paternalism. George Loewenstein, for those of you who are sort of familiar with behavioural economists, he developed something with various senior behavioural economists called asymmetric paternalism. Probably the most famous approach, though, is Richard Thaler and Cass Sunstein's libertarian paternalism. These are very, very similar, these soft forms of paternalism. We'll focus on libertarian paternalism today, because that's been the most sort of, popular and most widely discussed form, philosophical theory underlying all this. And in their sort of famous paper from 2003, and then their book that they followed up in 2008, that you've probably seen plastered across the tube advertising it, this libertarian paternalism informs nudge policy, coined, I think, in terms of some kind of technical definition by Thaler and Sunstein. So I'm going to be concentrating on what I think they said a nudge was in their paper and their book, that they published over the last 10 years. Now, the word libertarian paternalism, it sounds a bit like an oxymoron, doesn't it? Libertarian paternalism, right? Two things conflicting, really. What they mean by libertarian part of paternalism, in their theory, is that they argue that their approach is liberty-preserving. Right, so according to them, the approach shouldn't prevent people from continuing actions that they're already engaged with, if they so wish. Right, so they don't have to change their behaviour if they don't want. That's the libertarian paternalistic aspect of libertarian paternalism. So explicitly, as far as I can see anyway, excludes regulation or bans. Explicitly excludes regulation or bans, and I think that they say that in their book. The paternalistic aspect of libertarian paternalism, this is the notion that policymakers can change or reframe what they call the choice architecture, as sort of the environment choice context. Right? They can change this to kind of steer people to make different decisions. Decisions that policymakers might say are better for the individuals themselves. How do they reach this conclusion that something might be better for an individual than the individual themselves is currently choosing? They say that we should rely on people's reflective or deliberative choices. So we should really ask people to think about what they really want. And in many cases, because people face bounds on their rationality and they make errors, what they actually do choose, according to libertarian paternalism, conflicts with what they would really want in terms of their deliberative preferences. All right? No questions so far, and this is already one slide down. I'm starting to get a bit worried. We could be out here sooner than I thought.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
How are you defining, like, their reflection is, and would there be a scale? And how would you know that somebody actually is reflecting on what?
Well, as far as I mean, I'm not defining this. I'm just reporting Thaler and Sunstein are saying. I just think what they're suggesting is that if you really get people to think about their choices, I'm going to talk about this a little bit more detail as we go through it, the difference between deliberative and automatic or reflexive preferences. So I'll talk a bit more about that later. Okay. So the core of this approach really is that Richard Thaler, for those of you who don't know, is probably, I would say, probably the foremost behavioural economist in the world as a person that's trained in economics. I mean, you've got people like Daniel Kahneman and the late Amos Tversky, of course, who often considered to be the founding fathers of behavioural economics, but they're not really economists, they were psychologists. Thaler worked with those in the early days around issues of loss aversion that I'm going to talk about, and he's published a huge amount of literature. So he's probably the leading, I would say, probably the leading behavioural economist in the world with economics training. It could well be in line for the Nobel Prize if there is another Nobel Prize for economics given to behavioural economics. It could be in line for that. Okay. The core of the approach, libertarian paternalism, is that behavioural economic findings should be used to inform the reframing of the choice architecture. I'm going to talk about what I think are some of the main behavioural economic findings in a moment. There's lots of them. I'll point out some of the main ones. Right? So you change the framing, you change the choice context according to the findings of behavioural economics. You make people choose things in different ways, and the things that they now choose are more likely to reflect their deliberative preferences, what they would really want to choose for themselves if they were fully rational, engaged individuals, right? That's the idea of this approach, I think. Right? Now, nudges themselves, they're meant to appeal to reflexive cognitive processes. It's almost like kind of appealing to people's unconsciousness in a sense. People are not really thinking and calculating what they're doing. They're just making automatic responses. Right? And nudges are meant to appeal to that. And this falls under the sort of rubric of what's called dual process theory, I think, in psychology. And there's several different terms that have been used to dichotomize the different ways that people think in dual process theory. You can classify them as the automatic versus the reflective responses, right? People's automatic reactions compared to those that they really think about. Non-deliberative versus deliberative. Thaler and Sunstein themselves called it humans versus econs, for those of you who have ever read their book. So they say that, you know, the standard economic notion of, you know, the homo economicus would require somebody to be very calculative in order to weigh up all the possible options, choose those that maximise their utility. That requires a lot of thought. They say, quite rightly I think, that people often don't behave in those sorts of ways, they don't choose in those sorts of ways, they're more sort of reflexive. So the human being is not the homo economicus, they're two different things. So they classify this as humans versus econs. Stanovich and West, two psychologists, they classify it simply system one versus system two. And for those of you who read Kahneman's intellectual autobiography last year, this sort of infiltrates his intellectual biography really. It's just the same, it means the same thing but using different terms. None of these people, as far as I know, think that the brain is kind of separated into two parts where you've got like very different ways of thinking working in some contexts and other ways of thinking working in other contexts. It's very, very complex, and these sort of ways of thinking interact with each other. But these are just simply, kind of useful ways, perhaps, to sort of separate, dichotomize and categorize those two different ways of thinking, the automatic responses versus the real sort of calculative, considered responses. Now, it's generally thought, and this is probably due to human, the ways that human beings have evolved, that system one thinking is most of the time okay. You know, you can get through life. They're rules of thumb. It requires too much effort to think about every possible thing. And therefore, human beings have developed these sort of cognitive rules of thumb, these cognitive processes, automatic responses that most of the time are okay for us. So they can get us through life quite nicely. But in some circumstances, in the modern world at least, they can lead us to make very serious mistakes. Right? So for example, one example of this is something called present bias that I'll come back to. And present bias is simply that you place an enormous weight upon the immediate moment. This can actually be picked up in standard economic theory, but generally isn't, right? You place an enormous weight upon the immediate moments over and above more distant moments in terms of time. Right? Enormous weight on the immediate moment. You can imagine that this can lead to a lot of sort of mistakes that people could possibly make, isn't it? Is that, you know, you might eat too many sort of fatty foods and donuts and overlook the long-term consequences that they could have on your health. You might not save enough for your retirement because you're busy spending, you know, your money at John Lewis now, right? So you place an enormous weight on the immediate moment, overlook the future, right? So this is just one example of a system one type of behaviour that's, you know, can get us through life sort of okay, but according to the nudge theories, we could potentially be doing something better. Now, what they argue is that knowledge of system one, knowledge of these various cognitive effects, can help us to help inform policy design. If you design policies according to these people, if you design policies according to the ways in which people do actually think, and according to the ways in which they do actually process their decisions, right, then those policies are more likely to be effective, or are more likely to be more effective than they otherwise would be. So that's kind of like the essence, right? You get it? Get it? It's quite easy to understand, isn't it, I think? It's why it's so popular, because it's easy to understand. It's why even I can lecture on it reasonably competently, right? I've got a problem. I've got one problem with it. Well, I've got lots of problems with this, right? I'm going to point out just one problem. I'll come back to some more problems later. Right. I'll let you think about it. I want to see what people think about this. I'm wondering whether deliberative support for a goal equates to support for covert intervention on the behalf of government, not in terms of the private sector interventions, but in terms of public sector or government interventions. What I mean by that, right, is if you really get, if say you take the issue of weight loss, right, obesity, and you ask people, group of people, maybe a little bit overweight, if ideally, deliberatively, they'd like to lose some weight. Right. And most people might say, you know, yes, wouldn't they? I mean, you know, they're quite happy with the way that they are at the moment. But you can imagine a lot of people say, ideally, I'd like to lose a bit of weight, right? But does that equate necessarily to those people supporting covert policy, public sector policy implementation that's meant to feed into their unconscious, so they're not even aware of it, right? That will make that lead them to make choices where they might lose weight. So one example, a classic example of this that's been shown in the literature, a classic nudge, you're probably all aware of this one already. In a cafeteria, if you go into a cafeteria, right, and you can redesign the choice architecture so that you can prompt people to choose particular types of food. So if you have all the donuts at eye level as people walk into the cafeteria, or alternatively, you have all the fruit and vegetables at eye level as people walk into the cafeteria, it's been shown that people in the latter case will choose more to buy many more fruit and vegetables as they walk into the cafeteria than donuts. It's kind of feeding into their conscience. So you can still have the donuts in the shop, in the cafeteria. It's just that people might have to go to the back of the counter to reach across for them. All right? So it's just this idea that the salient for them, and they choose it. But would people choose that? Would people that are a little bit overweight, they say, ideally, I'd like to lose a bit of weight. But would they still necessarily believe then that the government should engage in covert policy design? What do you think? Anybody got any views about that? Anybody listening?
Anybody? What's the difference between, you know, covert and overt but not understood? In half the population will now understand the rational basis for a whole myriad of social interventions. So it doesn't matter whether it's covert or overt.
I don't know about that. I mean,
health and safety, you know, for aircraft.
I'll come on to, I think you can address these in other sorts of explicit ways, though. This is my budge policies later, right? It seems to be that you're almost kind of assuming that people are not... Can a government... Is it right for us to consider... For us to allow the government to consider the population as basically irresponsible? Is it right, and therefore, that for the government to choose covert policy design that is meant to lead people to make choices in ways that the government prefer, but that then the government says that this is what the deliberative preferences would match with? I'm not so sure. Anyway.
So, when you're talking about the government's covert policy design, say, to turn your example of the donuts at eye level, if people are experiencing private sector nudges of donuts at eye level, then... which has encouraged them to act in a certain way, then isn't the government, or if it was to do this, already entering a playing field that's...
I'm going to come back to this. I'll come back to this point. Probably not sufficiently or adequately, but I will come back to it. Yeah.
Your last point on the private sector can be regulated, who can regulate the government?
Oh yeah, I'm going to come back to that. Let's just jump on. Thanks. I'll give you my slides later, and you can talk about the last one. But okay.
Incredibly fashionable to explain everything in terms of behavioural, and then we can just step in and do the behavioural measures and everything will be fine.
Yeah.
But we need a large body of research first to establish whether these are really behavioural problems or whether there's some kind of perfectly rational problem that explains them. For example, if you look at Tobacman and the discounting equivalence, you can show that present biased behaviour can be extremely easily generated by an optimism, an over-optimism about, say, your income. Also, if they were really behavioural, then if people have a reflective self, which would prefer the fruit to be on eye level, why isn't there a private market incentive that people want the firms to put the fruit on eye level because now they're going to react to it? So you're calling, I mean, it's tempting to call everything behavioural and to come in and to give people nudges, but there is a lot of evidence to show that there are observationally equivalent explanations why stuff may not be behavioural after all. Perfectly, people may be perfect econs, how you call them.
Yeah.
But the thing is, due to information asymmetries,
That's good. I agree with all that. Let me just sort of clarify. I'm not advocating nudge policy here, right? I used to believe in nudge policy actually, but I've become one of these people that are sort of a heretic now, I suppose. Yeah, I mean, basically, if anything, if people propose stuff and it becomes popular, then for some reason I automatically start opposing it, even when I previously agreed with it. So I think your point's fair, but well made, and I'll sort of reflect on some of that, I think, or touch upon some of that, probably not all of it. Yeah.
Is there a more generalizable concept called deferred gratification, which is probably what you want to enhance more than a specific response to a specific stimulus?
Yeah, I'm going to sort of refer to that, I think, in a little while as well, maybe, to some extent. You can imagine, you know, that this sort of stuff touches on so much, doesn't it? Because it touches on every aspect of human life, really. So, I'll try and touch upon what I can within the next hour. Yeah, Peter.
Is it necessarily the case, when you accept this idea that what the deliberative self wants is necessarily good for you, what the reinforced self wants is necessarily bad for you? It's not clear that's always the case. Sometimes people will follow an impulse and be very pleased they did.
Yeah.
There's also, I have to say, an evolution model by Samuelson and Swinkles, who came out of Theoretical Economics in 2011, that explains why, sort of from an evolution point of view, sometimes it's good to have impulses that override the goals that you've learned deliberatively, because sometimes the goals you learn are not quite the best people that were in fitness.
Yeah, I agree with all that as well. I mean, I think that also, you know, there might be some cases where an instant action, a non-deliberative action, may be more optimal than a deliberative action. So I was thinking about, you know, you could think of your own examples of this, I suppose. The one I was thinking of is when you've got like a footballer, a striker who's on one-on-one with a goalkeeper. If he thinks about it too much, they generally miss, don't they? It's sort of an instinctive reaction that seems to have more success. Yeah.
Doesn't this sort of assume that people don't want to consciously engage and improve, and that it requires a government to come along and to manipulate people to get to do things other than engage them on a positive level? So rather than sort of on the surface education or any other of these things which are much more above board, we're now sort of moving towards systems where it's manipulation. That seems to be a very dark view of human nature.
Yeah, I used to really disagree with you on that, but now I agree with you, and that's what I'm going to talk about in a moment. I think it is, I'm worried, I'm a little bit worried. I'm not overly worried, because it's not that much of a big deal, I think. But I'm a little bit worried that governments could be almost be given a license with this stuff to be, as I said, be covert or be manipulative, and that worries me a bit. In democracies, I thought it was always the purpose of governments, at least in theory, to be open and transparent with their citizenry. So that's what I'm going to come on to a minute. I'll just move on. Can I move on a little bit? Because there's been a lot more questions on this second slide, I think, than the first slide. So, is explicit government covertness acceptable? That's what I've been talking about, right? So, nudgers, people who nudge advocates, they might say, yeah, that's all right, you know, because nudges are voluntary. You know, we're protecting people's right to choose their liberty, the libertarian aspects of libertarian paternalism. People don't, you know, people can carry on choosing in the way that they did before if they want to, but what worries me a little bit there is that if they're covert, if these are covert policies, if they're made to, meant to feed into the unconscious, can people voluntarily avoid them? Because they might not even know that they're there. They might not even know that they're being manipulated, if you want to use that word, to make a particular decision. Right? So can they select out of something that's been specifically designed to try to prompt, in some way, their unconscious behaviour? It seems to me to be a bit of a paradox there. I've got lots of problems with the nudge approach, really. I think it's incredibly confused, this area. It's just evolved into something that it wasn't originally meant to be, and it's all over the place. People are saying this is a nudge and that is a nudge and all sorts of nudges, and I'm wondering how. Anyway, this is one confusion that I have. Feeding into the unconscious, how can people voluntarily avoid those things? I think a point that somebody raised, I think it might have been you here, is that the nudge advocates would say that, you know, it's legitimate for government to counter nudges. Sorry, I put an extra nudge in there. I was trying to nudge you to think about nudges even more by putting two nudges in there, right? To counter the nudges of the private sector. The private sector use nudges all the time. Why can't the government use nudges to counter these nudges that might not be good for the population? You know, the private sector nudges, that is to say. But I was thinking about this, and isn't it the case that, you know, it's the private sector, so, you know, as citizens, we kind of pretty much allow them to do what they want, as long as they don't overstep the mark, right? So if we recognise that they're profit maximisers, most of them, in the private sector. We accept that. It's part of our society, this in the UK at least, right? And we accept that they can use nudges. We know that they nudge us to buy particular things and all that sort of business, right? But they can be regulated. If they overstep the mark, the government can step in and regulate these people, right? Which is what I'm going to be arguing for later, actually. But who regulates government? Nobody can regulate the government, can they?
Everyone regulates it in a democratic system. Parliament regulates it, people regulate it.
Well, Parliament's what I mean is the public sector then, the broad public sector, so I'd include Parliament as part of that, I suppose.
There are many sort of internal structures of accountability, monitoring.
A lot of it is self-regulation though, isn't it?
What about the courts? Can you explain the courts as self-regulation in those cases?
Okay.
And they can strike down laws on the basis of rationality, disproportionality.
They can do, and I think that this is one of the reasons they might challenge eventually this form of covert policy design, I suppose. But if we give the government free rein to explicitly use covert interventions to try to change people's behaviours, I don't know, I'm a bit uncomfortable that we have the regulator.
But is that a process problem? I mean, it sounds like a process problem, not an outcome. So in other words, would you have a problem if the population in theory understood the basis of which the nudge policy was constructed, even if only 1% actually, you know, read the materials? Would that solve
the
problem?
No, it wouldn't solve the problem for me. Some people argue that does. Luke Bovins does argue that solves the problem, I think. That doesn't solve the problem for me. So, you can't. I mean, I've had arguments with various colleagues and friends around this, and they, friendly arguments, that is, and they disagree with me on this. But I think that if the population knows that this is a general sort of policy direction, that doesn't legitimise, in my view, governments using specific interventions that fall under this general rubric. Right? Because even though they might agree with the general approach, they might still disagree with individual interventions that are trying to manipulate their behaviours in particular ways. It might relate a little bit to what I said earlier, you know, when people support the overall goal of deliberative goal of losing weight, but are resistant to the various interventions that might bring that about, right? Okay.
What about the media? So I can just imagine the newspaper front pages of, a tabloid or any other newspaper.
Yeah.
Government is trying to brainwash you into doing X, Y, or Z.
Yeah.
Newspapers, media would be mad about it, and that's another.
Well, that's fine, but we'll talk about that in a moment. But the UK is at the forefront in terms of national policy implementation around these sorts of policies, right? So if the media do regulate it, they might regulate it in some sense. But I'm arguing that I'm uncomfortable about this, so I agree with the media. See what I'm saying? Okay. Yeah.
Could it also be that nudge policies actually open up freedom? And an example here is like in New York City, many restaurants have to post their calorie counts on the menu. And that is a way that the government can encourage people to eat more healthily.
Yeah.
However, as a consumer, now I have that information to make as I So,
but
in
some ways, it
gets us more towards a more perfect market.
I agree, but I don't agree that that's a nudge. I'll come on to that. I don't think that that's a nudge.
Is putting health warnings on cigarettes a nudge?
Let me define what I think are the requirements for a nudge first, and then we can think about that a little bit. Right. So I'm going to define the requirements for a nudge in a moment. Okay. I feel like I'm on Hyde Park Corner now. And I don't even have a... Well, I do have a position, but I've not even come onto my position yet. Okay. So, I think that the private sector can be more openly regulated than can government, and we can disagree with that, we could have a whole debate about that, and I might end up agreeing with you. Okay. So, going back to Thaler and Sunstein's Bible, Nudge Bible, from 2008, you know, that's called, imaginatively, Nudge, right? These following four requirements are the four requirements for being a nudge. Right? And this has, in my view, been lost in the subsequent development of nudge proposals and nudge interventions. Lost even by the authors, the original authors of nudge. Everything seems to be a nudge these days, and the approach to me is intellectually empty as a consequence of that. These, I think, are the original requirements from the reading of the book. A nudge should be liberty-preserving and not involve any regulation or bans. Right, it should be liberty. You can carry on doing what you previously did if you so wish. It should not significantly change economic incentives. If it does significantly change economic incentives, it could be accused of being somewhat... When you sort of manipulate somebody into doing some particular thing.
Coercive.
Yeah, it could be a coercive, right? I was just testing it. I knew it all along. I was just testing it. Right? It could be a bit coercive. And I think that this is one reason... Actually, these first two reasons are reasons why I think that the nudge approach has become very popular, as I'll talk about in a moment, in policy circles in many countries over the last few years. Firstly, because a lot of the... governments that have really taken nudge to their heart, which are quite right-leaning, right? They don't really like... Not all of them. I mean, the Obama administration... Well, you could argue whether it's quite right-leaning or not, I suppose. But they don't like the... You know, there tends to be governments that ideologically probably don't really like the idea of regulations or bans, right? And the idea of not changing significantly economic incentives, it implies, really, that these things are going to be cheap to implement. Right, and cheapness is at the essence at the time being, isn't it? Right? So I think those are two reasons why this approach has attracted so much attention in policy. They shouldn't involve overly sort of, you know, overt campaigns of information or persuasion to be a nudge. It should be trying to feed into the unconscious in some sense, right? Okay. All these other things might be good. I support these other things, and they might be good in and of themselves. But if they involve these things, then they're not nudges, right? Nudge precludes these types of things. And finally, it should be informed by the findings of behavioural economics, according to the original sort of definitions, as far as I can gather anyway, within the original books. I mean, I've been learning behavioural economics for more than 20 years now, and I can't see the behavioural economics in some of this stuff. Right? You might be able to enlighten me. Okay. Any questions? Yes. Well, I'm going to talk about that one in a minute. I don't know whether that's a nudge as originally defined, because it does involve regulation also. It involves regulation, so how can it be a nudge?
It wasn't regulation,
it's like opt-out. Yeah, but the changing in the requirements required changes in process that were sort of, you know, enforced by government. So we'll talk about it. I'll come on to that in a moment, right? Okay. Anything else? All right. Okay. So, behavioural economics is key here, isn't it? It's very important to this whole approach. It informs the approach, right? What is behavioural economics? This is a tricky question, actually. There's no broadly accepted definition of behavioural economics. You know, you've got like a theory, standard economic theory, which is a holistic theory, neoclassical economic theory, it's a holistic theory. You don't have that with behavioural economics, right? Behavioural economics really is a set of observations that systematically violate the assumptions or the axioms of standard economic theory. By systematically, I mean, and some of my students are here actually, so they'll be sort of thinking, I know that. It means that they in some sense deliberately violate these axioms. They're not making errors, it seems. Right? Systematically violating the assumptions of standard economic theory. There are some behavioural economists who are trying to put together a holistic theory. Matthew Rabin is trying to do this. I don't know whether they're going to be successful. I think if they try to put forward like a holistic theory, then you'll be able to pick holes in that as well, in the same way as you can pick holes in neoclassical economic theory. But we'll see how far they go. If they do it, they'll get the Nobel Prize for that, I think. So I think that behavioural economics can be thought of as a library of tools, you know, these systematic observations, a library of tools that you can use on a case-by-case basis, probably, to inform your policy design when you're trying to design a particular intervention for a particular purpose. You might think, people might well behave in this particular way that's been observed over and over again, systematically by behavioural economists to occur when they're making their decisions, right? I'm going to point out some of these library of tools to you in a moment, right? I don't by any means exhaust the list of behavioural economic findings here, but I've put forward to you what I think are some of the main ones, okay? Loss aversion, very important finding in behavioural economics, right? What it means basically is that people seem to attach in many circumstances a weight to losing a particular amount that is much greater magnitude than the weight that they attach to gaining that same amount. So for example, if you lose £5 in the street, that hurts you much more than the joy that you feel from gaining finding £5 in the street, right? This has been observed time and time and time again. Systematically, generally actually, for most material goods, it seems as though the weight that people attach to the loss is roughly twice as much as the weight that they attach to the gain. They value losses loom roughly twice as great as gains of the same magnitude. That can't be picked up by standard economic theory. Standard economic theory can explain a small discrepancy for low sort of value goods, but not the goods, not discrepancies of that size. The sort of hypothesis that loss aversion exists has been around for a long, long time. Right? This is Adam Smith back in the late 18th century, saying pain is, in almost all cases, a more pungent sensation. He'd have the Scottish accent, of course, wouldn't he? And the opposite and corresponding pleasure. But I don't do sort of impressions. Even if I'd seen him speak, I wouldn't be able to do it. The one almost always depresses us much more below the ordinary, or what may be called the natural state of our happiness, than the other ever raises us above it. Right? We know these things exist. They're in literature. You only have to read literature to know. You only have to, you know, think about it for yourselves to know that these things exist. The contribution of modern behavioural economics is that they've empirically observed it. So this has been observed time and time again over the last 30, 40 years. It's been empirically observed and measured, you know, roughly twice as much. Right? That's the contribution of modern behavioural economics. Could have big policy implications regarding investment versus disinvestment decisions. So if you consider the National Institute of Health and Clinical Excellence in the UK has a responsibility, or remit, I think it still does, of deciding which interventions are cost-effective for the NHS, finds it much easier to think and make recommendations about interventions that are not yet online. Is this new intervention cost-effective? Than making recommendations about disinvestment. Is this old intervention that exists? Should we get rid of it? Very difficult to do that. People have already got it. Giving it up is a loss. Right, very difficult. It's all tied into those sorts of notions. And endowment effects. People care much more about things that they already have than they do care about that very same thing before they had it. Right? You buy a pen and you'll want much more to pay. You'll want somebody generally, if it's a nice pen, to pay you much more to give up the pen than you were willing to pay for the pen in the first place. It's called an endowment effect. Yeah.
Work aversion, it's loss aversion, it's work aversion. have to work to adopt a new idea, and we have to work to let the other one go.
Could be, yeah, transaction costs, I suppose that falls into, yeah.
It's not necessarily that you're losing something, but you have to adapt to something.
Yeah, in that case, probably that comes into it as well. But you know, these things have been observed where there's no work at all involved in empirical studies. Right? Just gaining and giving up things, no work involved. I could give you a coffee mug and say, how much are you willing to sell that coffee mug for? And then I could say, how much are you willing to buy this exact same coffee mug for? One involves giving up the good, the other involves gaining the good. Generally, people want much more money to give up the good than they do. And they're willing to pay for that same good, related to endowment effects. I'm going to move on. You can think about it, and you can remain as sceptical as you are now. It's fine. I would encourage that. Definitely. Right? Definitely encourage scepticism. This is the LSE. This is the home of scepticism, isn't it? We've got to be sceptical. That's the whole sort of new banner, I think. Present bias. We talked about this a little bit a moment ago. People do place an enormous weight upon the immediate moment compared to future moments. Much more than, well, standard economic theory can actually pick this up. It's sometimes called hyperbolic discounting, or immediate gratification, or even just the immediacy effect. It's got various terms, right? But applications of standard theory don't generally use it. They just use a kind of exponential discount rate, usually, right? So knowledge of this, it's been around for, you know, we know this. We know people behave in these ways. David Hume, Adam Smith's friend, back in the late 18th century again. There is no quality in human nature which causes more fatal errors in our conduct than that which leads us to prefer whatever is present to the distant and remote. You can pick out any philosophy, well, most of the philosophers, classic philosophers, and they'll make statements similar in nature to this. The contribution, again, of modern behavioural economics is that they've observed this empirically. We know that it exists intuitively. Modern behavioural economists have observed this empirically. George Lowenstein is the big figure, I think, around these sorts of issues.
Can you speak up a bit? There's some competition from next door.
Oh, I'm tired already. I'll try, Peter. If I speak up too much, these will tell me to quiet it down a bit. That's the. Okay, probability weighting. Probability weighting and loss aversion together, they are basically the main components of what's called prospect theory, which was Kahneman and Tversky's main contribution, right? Kahneman got the Nobel Prize for that. That's just an aside. Probability weighting, this is the finding that people tend to overweight small probabilities and underweight large probabilities. Right? This is important, right? This is important because it might provide an explanation. One of the reasons it's important, it might provide an explanation for the reason why people are often, the same person often demonstrates differential risk attitude across different decisions. Something that standard neoclassical economic theory explained away, really. You're not allowed to do that, I don't think, generally. It's more complex than that, but generally you're not allowed to do it in standard economic theory. If you're risk averse, it's assumed generally that you'll always be risk averse. We know people don't do that, don't we? We know that the same person buys a lottery ticket, is risk seeking, and will buy insurance, is risk averse. Can I just finish my sentence and then I'll come to you, right? And a possible reason for why they might do that, not the definitive reason, but a possible reason is they might overweight small probabilities. So they overweight the small probability that their washing machine will break down over the next 3 years, and they'll buy appliance insurance, which is ridiculous, right? But they do that. They pay a lot of money for appliance insurance, right? And yet that same person will buy a lottery ticket. They might overestimate the small, the very, very tiny probability that they'll win, you know, 50 million euros on the Euro lottery next week.
Yeah, just to comment, since the title of this is Behavioural Economics and Government, it's definitely worth looking into the macro implications of loss aversion and things like the endowment effect. I think this is widely overlooked. If you think that in neoclassical economics, capital should be allocated efficiently to entrepreneurs who are most talented and promise the highest return, right? Should make sense. Like, most talented, get the highest return projects, should get capital should be allocated efficiently. If you put an endowment effect in there, you can suddenly explain lower total factor productivity on a macro level, because suddenly the capital stays with the people who are maybe not so talented, because you're less likely to give something away than you already have, which means you no longer have efficient allocation of capital on a macro scale, which opens up a huge area for macro implications of this kind of thing.
Yeah, very good. That's a good point. I agree with that. I mean, I think we need to think about this these things in all aspects of policy, actually. But yeah, that's a very good point. So probability weighting, I've explained that. Related to this, I've just talked about risk attitudes. This is complex, but generally, I won't explain it in complex ways. Generally, prospect theory predicts people often to make risk-averse choices in the domain of gains. I won't go about this in great depth, but risk-seeking choices in the domain of losses. When they can lose something, loss aversion predicts that people will be, in some circumstances, where the probability is large enough, risk-seeking, right? And this is important. I think this is potentially very important, because it might explain why people find it very difficult to cut their losses. Right? When you lose, you see these guys, don't you, who work for investment bankers, and they've gone away and they've played these kind of roles where they're trying to sort of play the market by themselves without informing the company. They lose an amount of money. Instead of cutting their losses at that point, they play ever more risky and riskier decisions, and end up potentially bringing down the whole financial system. Right? And I think we can apply that probably most people to their own lives. Once you start losing things, it's very difficult to cut your losses, to know when to stop. And that might be because people are risk-seeking. They're driven to be risk-seeking in the domain of losses.
There's a better explanation of what the financial traders do, which is once you've lost 10 million, then you've lost your job, you're in trouble anyway. So whether you lose 10 million or 100 million...
but they might have started out losing 50,000.
Okay, but once you get to a certain point, before they bring back down, at that point it's rational to keep taking this too.
Okay. My example might not have been a perfect one, but I think in many cases it does seem to be the case that people find it difficult to cut their losses. Even sometimes governments, right, behave in these types of ways.
Is that how people get addicted to gambling?
It could be, yeah. I think
when it's all back.
Yeah. Who's the guy, the economic guy at the Financial Times, what's his name? The one who writes about behavioural stuff. He gave a talk here. He's got his name now. But there's been studies on the Deal or No Deal, the TV programme Deal or No Deal. And people don't know when to stop. When they start losing about, and they end up losing everything. It's similar sort of thing. Preference reversals, right? This is important as well, right? Standard economic theory has an assumption called procedural invariance. What that means is, no matter how you elicit somebody's preferences, they should show the same preference order in between goods. You offer them an apple or a pear, and if they prefer a pear, they should be willing to pay more for the pear. Right? Now, there are certain goods. These observations have been sort of reported now since the 1960s by psychologist Paul Slovic, and then they were taken up by economists to some extent. Right? There are certain goods where people choose A rather than B, but then place a higher monetary value upon B. And the goods where these occur, usually risky goods, right? But the ones that the observations around this. So if you offer people a modest probability of winning, if you offer people a higher probability of winning a modest amount, call that good one, and then you offer them a modest probability of winning a very high amount, and you ask them to choose between those two goods, and they have the same or similar expected value, often people tend to choose the high probability of winning a modest amount, right? When you ask them to place separate monetary valuations on those things, they tend to put the highest monetary valuation on the good that involves a modest probability of a very large amount. They probably focus upon the very large amount and overlook the modest probability of it occurring. Right? Anchoring an insufficient adjustment is what it's called. Right? This is important because it suggests that in some circumstances, right, contrary to what standard economic theory predicts, preference formation is a constructive process. People don't carry around inside them algorithms such as expected value maximization or expected utility maximization a lot of the time, especially for unfamiliar goods. They construct their preferences according to how the good is framed. Feeds into libertarian paternalism. You can change the choice environment and you can influence people's choices. Right? Preference reversals. The final observation of behavioural economics that I point out is not one that I've gone about a great deal, but I like it, and I'm going to be writing something with Matteo about this. Fairness in ultimatum games. I think this was first uncovered by Germans in the 1970s, I think, but now it's a very common finding. And what it is, it sort of flies in the face a little bit of the notion of the mainstream economic view that people are entirely self-interested. Self-interested utility maximizers. Possibly, it might violate. It might sort of challenge that to some extent. And how the experiments go are that you could have two people, one a giver and the other a taker, right? And they don't know each other, they sit in different rooms, they're entirely anonymized from each other, and you give the giver, say, £10. And you say to the giver, you can apportion a share of your money to the taker, you don't ever see this person. If the taker agrees to that split, you both keep the money that you've got. If the taker doesn't like it and disagrees, then you both end up with nothing, right? Now, according to the sort of self-interested sort of utility-maximising view, the taker should offer very little. He should offer 50p or something, or even less than that. The giver should offer 50p or something like that, less than that, right, to the taker. Because the taker will prefer that over nothing at all. 50p is better than nothing, right? But what you often find is that takers don't accept that at all. In empirical observations, usually the split is roughly 50-50, a little bit less than 50-50. But very, very, you know, close to being an equal amount. So there might be something in us that we care about fairness, possibly. You might just think that we know that this person's going to say no, and therefore it's better for us to have something than nothing. Right? But it seems to possibly conflict with the standard economic view that we're self-interested utility maximizers. And this might be something that's not just endemic in us as human beings, it might be endemic in other animals as well. So I'm going to show you a clip. You've been listening to one monkey, I'm going to show you some clips, a clip from other monkeys. These are capuchin monkeys. It's from David Attenborough program. And I think that this nicely shows possibly the ultimatum game in capuchin monkeys. Oh, I need the sound. Wait a minute. You know how I get the sound on this? It's not playing, you know. Just click on that.
Yeah. Yeah. Click that thing.
Sorry. Where?
Click that. Okay. And unclick that. Okay.
You're not getting the commentary, are you? But basically, I need to start this again because it's David Attenborough's voice, but for some reason it's not coming out, so I need to start this again. For some reason, you're not getting David Attenborough's voice. The scenario, basically, you've got two capuchin monkeys. The one inside the cage has a rock. And the other one needs the rock in order to smash open or get out these nuts from this kind of cylinder, right? And the idea is that why isn't this... Will the second one, once he's smashed the nuts or got the nuts out of the cylinder, if he's able to do that, will he just keep all the nuts for himself? Or will he decide to share them? He can keep them for himself. The other one's in a cage, right? So he struggles for a long time to get these nuts out of this thing. It's better with the commentary. So the one in the cage is getting pretty impatient with this sort of lock. Eventually it works it out. Gets the horse. Okay, so the LSE, we've learned that the LSE's sound system doesn't like David Attenborough commentaries there, right? But you can see, you know, interesting, isn't it? Kind of interesting, right? I think that's kind of interesting. I'll say it again, it's interesting. Fourth time I've said that. I think it's interesting. I can't stop that. Alright, so I think those are some of the main findings of behavioural economics. I want to try to now talk a little bit about the nudges that have been put forward. Some of them, you know, not all of them, obviously, there's millions of them. And I'm going to sort of challenge or discuss a little bit whether that, are these really nudges, as according to those original definitions of what a nudge should be. So nudge, as I've said already, has attracted huge amounts of interest, isn't it, from policymakers in many countries, often sort of right of centre countries, right of centre governments, it has to be said. But it's attracted interest from Denmark, from Sweden, Netherlands, the US. The Obama Kastenstein was a key figure in the Obama administration until last summer, you know, of Thaler and Sunstein fame. Richard Thaler himself advises the British government around these sorts of things. The country, however, that's probably implemented this idea the most in terms of central government policy formation is this one, the UK. So soon after he became elected in 2010, David Cameron set up in number 10 Downing Street in the Cabinet Office a small unit called the Behavioural Insights Team. And this is colloquially known as the Nudge Unit. Some of you have probably heard of it, right? It's run by a guy called David Halpin, who's very good, actually. And they've published a whole range of reports now, several reports, freely available obviously on their website. Quite interesting reads, actually, for those of you who are interested in this area. And they've published on health policy, these are just examples, they might have published on more by now. Personal energy saving, you know, around electricity, gas saving, those sorts of things. Reducing tax fraud, so a whole range of areas. Right? Now, you know, I've looked through these kind of reports now in quite some depth, and I'm trying to think, do they satisfy the requirements for being a nudge? Which behavioural economic insights are they attaching themselves to or being formed from? A lot of emphasis, or quite a bit of emphasis, has been put on the notion, as we said over here earlier, about changing the default, and I think this probably got something to do with reference points as well. So a classic example of this that's been put forward is trying to increase the rates of organ donation, at least. Now, the UK traditionally was what's called an opt-in country around organ donation. You had to go out and specify if you wanted to be an organ donor. You used to carry a card around with you. Now you register online, I think. There's many opt-in countries for organ donation. Basically, generally, around 20-odd% of the population, roughly 15 to 25% of the population, generally agree to be donors in opt-in countries. You could have opt-out countries. Right? And we do have many of those. I think Austria is one, France. I think there are several countries that have opt-outs. So you have to specify if you don't want to be an organ donor. Right? And in those countries, anywhere between 80 and almost 100% of the adult population are registered as organ donors. So you get huge differences in the percentage of the adult population that wish, or at least say, that they're happy to be organ donors, depending on whether you have an opt-in or an opt-out policy. The British actually have plumped for a system called prompted choice now, I think. So what that is that when you renew your driving licence now, or you apply for your driving licence, there's a page on the screen that says, do you want to be an organ donor? And you have to say yes or no, and click one of them. Otherwise the application is not processed. So it's kind of like a slightly softer form of opt-out, I suppose. Okay. Other opt-out policies. I think probably a lot of you, if you watch TV, have seen all these advertisements really recently around corporate pension plans. What the government have introduced there is in the corporate sector now, in large companies, I can't remember the exact number of people that have to be employed, but people who work for them have to be offered a corporate pension plan when joining the company, and have to say if they want to opt out of that. Before, in some corporations, people had to, you know, specify if they wanted to opt in. They've moved to a system of opt out. So they're trying to challenge here a little bit, possibly the notion of present bias, or even the status quo bias or inertia. Right? People are not saving enough for their retirement, so they're trying to address that to some extent. Now, these might be good policies. I don't know. You'll have to think for yourselves whether they're good policies, but are they a nudge? Are they liberty preserving? I'm not sure about that. They might be. But imagine if you don't want to donate your organs, but you're embarrassed about saying you don't want to donate your organs. You think that would signal that you're a bad person. When you were allowed to opt in, that wasn't a problem for you, but it becomes a problem if you now have to opt out, don't you? You might be being coerced to some extent. I should imagine there's a few people like that. So maybe liberty preserving. Don't seem to involve huge economic incentives, that's fine. Perhaps don't involve overt uses of information or persuasion. But they do seem to require some act of regulation, don't they? To reintroduce a prompted choice policy in this country regarding applications for driving licence must have involved some act, some use of rules and regulations somewhere down the line.
That's a really, really important point. I mean,
that's a really what?
A very formal point. I mean, a lawyer would be hard-pressed to defend that, and I'm one of them. Because, you know, it might be, I'm not even sure if the statute instrument was necessary, but I'd say not. Actually, I'm going to wager that it wasn't necessary.
Yeah.
To actually give effect to that. To that,
so points of interest, though. I mean, I think the general point might still apply. When you're looking across different countries, they require different acts of legislation, I think, for different purposes. So in some countries, they might not require acts of legislation. In other countries, some things might require acts of legislation, right, or regulation, right? But the thing is, the point is that these should be kind of generic, so it shouldn't really require any.
It can't be, because legal system. You know, the US perspective is based on whatever they need to adopt laws, so you have to adjust it by country.
Okay, so I won't dwell on this one too much. Whether it requires regulation or not, I think, is a moot point there. I think it possibly does. I don't think it's necessarily a bad policy, but I'm sceptical about whether this can be classified as a nudge, right? And some people might say, so what? If it works, let's just do it. Who cares if it's a nudge or not? But I care, right? And the reason I care, well, there's many reasons, but one reason I care is because, as I'll talk about in a moment, behavioural economics is often equated falsely with nudge. A lot of people are thinking that these are one and the same thing. And if standard economic theoreticians start seeing that a lot of nudge interventions are not actually informed by behavioural economics, that weakens, I think, behavioural economics in the eyes of the economics profession, even further than it already is. And I want to try and do a little bit, you know, minuscule amount, I can't even say it, but you know what I mean, minuscule amount to try to prevent that from happening. Right. And I think that there's a real danger of that happening at the moment, because these nudges, everything's being classified as a nudge, and I'm concerned about that. There are interventions that have called for further manipulation of the reference rate. You can do this through highlighting benchmarks for good behaviour. So one of these might be the 5-a-day campaign. Very successful campaign, isn't it? 5-a-day campaign. 10 years ago, 15 years ago, did anybody know that they were supposed to eat 5 portions of fruit and veg a day? And in fact, I don't think that's even the right number. It's just been drilled into it. All right? I think scientifically it's not even the right number. Right? It's been drilled into us. And we see now, we think now, anything less than 5 portions of fruit and vegetables a day is a bad thing, it's a loss. So a lot of us now are driven to eat this amount of fruit and vegetables a day to meet this benchmark, right? there, around manipulation of the reference points also, there's the public reporting of behaviour. The public, this is important. I think that this potentially is an effective policy implement instrument, possibly. One of these is around the notion of smart meters. I don't know if you've heard of these, but people can sign up to have a smart electricity meter in their home. Right? And one of the things it might do, you can program it to do, is to give you an indication of whether you're using more or less electricity than a comparably sized, on average, for comparably sized households. Right? So you're given a reference point, really. You're given a reference point. If you're using more electricity than comparably sized households, you might think that that's a loss, and you might be driven down to use less. If you're using less, you might think I'm doing all right here. Can I just mention the tax payments as well? There's been an experiment, I think, in the southwest of the country. Sometimes these little experiments are done. They're done once, and they're put out as being this great innovation, when really we need much more evidence. But there's been one that's been put out that said that when they're trying to collect tax payments from people, they say that 90% of the people in your local area pay their taxes on time. So it may again be giving people a reference point. If you're not paying your taxes on time, it might be driving you up to that reference point. Sorry.
And just on the smart meter, it seems more like it's societal pressure to go and be like average or below.
Could be that.
But that seems a lot like the same as the organ donation. I don't see that much of a difference, because it's like the reason why you would choose yes, even though you had you were uneasy about it, would be because of you've been taught, oh, it's the right thing to do. It's still.
That could be. I mean, I suppose the smart meters one, I suppose it could be that going in people's brains. But these things are not publicised in the community. It's just the average is given, and that's given to you. So nobody else really knows your own personal consumption, even though people that might be still going on in people's brains anyway. But you could be right. There could be a social...
Sorry, isn't it more like I'm spending more than I could?
Could be that.
I could save a bomb here if I change my behaviour.
Could possibly be that, if they work. There's not strong evidence that these things work, but they've been put out as possibilities.
There's a possible issue with the smart meters.
Sorry?
Another possibility with smart meters is that, in the sense of people, if you're being watched, you behave better when they're being watched.
And yeah.
It's something which is like someone is watching you.
Yeah.
People actually look at how much I'm using, like they're embarrassed by it.
Yeah, that's true. And you don't even have to be watched. It's called priming, actually, right? I'll tell you about a study that was quite interesting. It was done at Newcastle, right? In Newcastle. And it was an office. And people could go and collect tea and coffees for themselves. They could help themselves to tea and coffee, right? But they had to voluntarily put in a little box some money every time they had a cup of tea and coffee to pay for further supplies, you know, coffee and tea and milk and whatever, right? Now, they had alternating weeks. Some weeks, the administrators put a picture of the flowers up on just above the coffee point, right? And then other weeks, they put a picture of an eye, right? Just a picture of an eye above the coffee point, right? And they did this for several weeks, and they alternated. Every time there was an eye there, the voluntary payments were significantly higher, very significantly higher than when just flowers there. So you don't even need to be watched. You just need a picture of an eye, right? I tell you, we're not much cleverer, probably, than those capuchin monkeys. But probably even less clever. There's a lot of applications of economic incentives running through these reports. And that, it doesn't trouble me in and of itself, but it troubles me in the sense that these, a lot of them, may just be applications of standard economic theory, and we should acknowledge that if they are. So one example, there's lots of examples. One example is that you can offer, they're proposed offering children, diabetic children, Nintendo points if they take their blood sugar measurements regularly, right? They offer people holidays from, the proposal is to offer people holidays from council tax payments if they get their lofts insulated, that sort of stuff. There's Lazy Town initiative in Iceland, right? Lazy Town was introduced in the mid-1990s in Iceland, and it's basically a series of incentives and contracts between children and their parents. So, and labelling stuff as well, relabelling stuff. So you enter a contract with your parents about going to bed early and eating the right foods, and they relabel fruit as sports candy and all this sort of rubbish, right? But what they found after the introduction of Lazy Town is that childhood obesity, it might be a coincidence, but what they found is that childhood obesity levels in Iceland fell. The only example in the developed world where that happened over that time period. Right, so the government in this country are proposing using these sorts of initiatives as well. Now, I am worried. I mean, I'm not worried that these things might work. They might work fine in and of themselves. You might think that that's okay if you want to. If you're not too worried about government, public sector manipulation, if the government are using these things, you might want to use them. I can't see the behavioural economics in all of these things. There might be in some of them. If you use the Nintendo points, you could argue, for example, these are very small financial incentives, right? Very small non-financial incentives in many cases. It might be feeding into the notion of hyperbolic discounting or present bias. So something that was unpleasant to do, taking your blood sugar measurement, maybe made a bit more enjoyable, a bit more fun, if you think that you're getting some Nintendo points out of this. It's linked to this notion that's colloquially called now fun theory. If you make things fun that are otherwise unpleasant to do, or more fun, or less unenjoyable, people are more likely to do them in the immediate moment. They put a lot of weight on the immediate moment. These things, though, I'm wondering if they're all getting a bit gimmicky. They're fun. You look at them, you think, oh, that's great. You know, that's really interesting. I like that. And you talk about it, and you talk about it with policymakers. Let's introduce these little gimmicky things. But I wonder if they're going to solve the big problems that society faces. If you do take obesity as a problem within contemporary Western societies, for example, and even non-Western societies, is this next example likely to solve the obesity crisis, if there is one? I'll show you. This was on Richard Thaler's Twitter feed. In Paris, that one. People glide and they're fun. Are they likely to solve the obesity crisis? I don't know. You see these piano stairs, people like they put sensors in stairs and people walk upstairs. Can you imagine that working in Holborn Tube Station? Yeah? How many times would you use it? Okay, there's some more fundamental issues. I've got 15 minutes left, so I think there's those sorts of problems. I mean, are these nudges really not? There's more fundamental issues, I think, about this nudge approach, and I'm going to touch on some of these by somebody I respect a lot, actually, Robert Sugden, who's one of the great philosopher economists, I think, in the world, actually. Now, he argues, how do we determine the directions in which it is legitimate to nudge people, right? How do we decide what's good for them? What's in their best interest? Well, the libertarian paternalist, they would say, well, we'd seek their deliberative preferences. You know, we'd ask people to really think about this stuff, really call, deep down, what do you really want to happen to you, right? But Sugden comes back and says, there's no guarantee that the bounds in our rationality, right, the errors that we make, our inability to process information, all of this stuff, right, are absent from our deliberative preferences. They've been observed to be endemic in our reflexive preferences. How can we be sure that these are absent from our deliberative preferences? Or even from the deliberative preferences of policymakers, actually. Right? Now, it might be the case that deliberative answers are just responses to pressure, you know, from the interviewer. It might be the case that you just want to tell the interviewer what they want to hear, what you think that they want to hear. Right? So an interviewer comes to see you, you're a smoker, they say, you know, really deep down, do you want to stop smoking? You say, yeah, of course I want to stop smoking. But you might say that because you think that person wants to hear that. Right? Possibly. So Bob Sugden argues the best approximation, really, of what people want is what they choose. It's actually what they choose. Right? Most people are quite clever, really, aren't they, about what they really want a lot of the time. So maybe the best... And Bob said, don't worry about utility maximisation. It doesn't matter if people are maximising utility. They might not want to. So let's just observe their choices. Right? So Robert Sugden, would argue we ought to be cautious about giving policymakers the licence to interfere in individual lifestyle behaviours. We should be cautious. Do policymakers really know, can they really know what is good for us? Right, this is just questions I'm throwing out. So then you kind of think, well, you know, no, they don't know that, right? So can we give them any grounds to interfere? If you do reach that conclusion, can we give them any grounds to interfere? Well, I think you can, can't you? You can give them grounds to interfere there may be many more grounds for the governments to interfere, of course. I can think of two main ones for now that I'll just throw out now. One is when a vital service would not be provided by the market. So you can imagine medical care for elderly people, unless you had some kind of social insurance system of some sort, you know, a lot of people wouldn't be able to afford it, would they, that were elderly or poor. One of the reasons why the Americans established Medicaid and Medicare in the mid-60s was to fill these gaps in insurance coverage, right? This is a view that's shared by economists across the whole range of the economic spectrum. The ideological spectrum, actually. So Keynes and Hayek, you know, polar opposites in almost anything, both believed that it was okay, or it was good, for governments to provide a universal health care insurance system. I think. Or Hayek certainly believed that, and I'm pretty sure Keynes believed it as well. Because this is Keynes' argument: government should interfere when a vital service would not be provided by the market. Second main reason, I think, is when actions cause harm to others. If individual actions cause harm to others, then surely that it's legitimate for the government to regulate against those actions. Right? The old John Stuart Mill argument, really. Right? The essence of J.S. Mill's philosophy. So this, then, is why I come on to budge rather than nudge. Right? Nudge is an anti-regulatory approach, as far as I can see. This is from Thaler and Sunstein's their famous book in 2008, and I quote, "In many domains, including environmental protection, family law and school choice, we will be arguing that better governance requires less in the way of government coercion and constraint, and more in the way of freedom to choose. If incentives and nudges replace requirements and bans, government will be both smaller and more modest." This is music to the ears of, you know, the soon after elected Conservative led government. Okay. Now, I think in this there's a danger that ideology, if we're linking the policy making decisions up to this theory, there's a danger that ideology could trump substance. Nothing new in that, I suppose, but I'll point it out anyway. So we have these public health responsibility deals, for example, in the UK, and the essence of those is that the government reached some kind of agreements with the food industry, the alcohol industry, etc., right? And they said that if you self-regulate, we will not impose any further regulation on you. You know, it's to simplify, but that's the core of the approach. Right? So it's kind of an anti-regulatory approach. It fits in with this idea of nudge. The idea is that these companies, these industries, will use nudge-style interventions to get people to make better choices. These companies don't care really about that. The bottom line for them is profit maximisation. The chief executive of Sainsbury's explicitly said that, you know, in the news. The bottom line is profit maximisation. They go where the customers go. They're not too interested in leading the customers anywhere unless it's towards the maximisation of profits. Right? The public health responsibility deals, in my reading of them, is that so far, by and large, they've been a failure, really. Right? So I'm wondering whether government is hiding, almost using the nudge sort of ideology, the whole sort of concept of this thing, is almost like a smokescreen by which to hide from more effective forms of intervention that they might not be so ideologically committed to. So I said, has nudge become a fudge? That was supposed to be humorous, but clearly, on the basis of empirical evidence, my hypothesis is not proven. But nudge is often equated with behavioural economics. Nudge and behavioural economics are the same thing. That's not true. That's rubbish, right? In my view. Right? So many people seem to believe that behavioural economics is necessarily anti-regulatory. Behavioural economics is just about human decision making. It's about the cognitive processes we use and the observations of that. And we can use those information, we can use those observations to help inform what we might expect to be effective regulation. We can use it for regulatory purposes. Right? So knowledge of behavioural economics can help inform regulation. So behavioural economic informed regulation, I'm going to call it budge. And this is explicitly so that I become as famous as Thaler and Sunstein. I need a catchword. Budge. Behaviour. It's not going to work, is it? I can see it. I'm seeing it's only going to lead to disappointment. But, you know, that's nothing new, is it? I'm used to it. It's my reference point is disappointment. So it's no longer disappointment. Right? So, an example to finish, right? And I'm going to finish on this example. And it's only a small example, but I think it's quite telling. And, you know, hopefully you can go away and think about examples of your own about this if you really want to. And you've got nothing better to do, which I'm sure is not the case. Industries, as you know, marketing expertise, they're implicitly, these are behavioural economic experts, really, implicitly. These are the leading behavioural economic experts in the world. They've been doing this stuff for years, the marketing industry. They don't recognise that these are explicit behavioural economic findings, but they're interested in how humans make their decisions because they, for years, have been trying to sell products, right? So they use all this stuff implicitly in their advertising campaigns, etc., right? And I think that we can fairly say, or you might disagree with this, that a lot of these industries use these techniques to get us to buy more of this stuff than we really want, probably, right? They use it to get people to buy more cigarettes than they want to smoke. They use it to get to buy more donuts than they want to eat, more consumer products than you can afford. All of these things add up and cause problems, right? So I'm categorising this as a harm against individuals, an action that is a harm against individuals. So I think, on that basis, with that argument, following J.S. Mill, that the government is legitimate, when it identifies where this occurs, is to regulate against these actions, regulate against these harms. Right? So I'm going to give a specific example of this, regulating the food industry. Right? Now, some of you have probably heard about the traffic light system of labelling, right? What that is that you can ask or request or even legislate for food companies to put red signal, amber signal or green signal on their food products, indicating how high the calorie content is in that, how energy dense the product is, right? These were successfully opposed by, can you imagine, that in the EU level and at the British level, by the cheese and the chocolate manufacturers. Right? These are all going to get a red signal, aren't they, on their products, right? Because, well, chocolate is cheese, is sugar and fat, essentially. That's what it is. Right? So they successfully opposed this. I could give you stories about how they did this, but I think they did this in very undesirable ways, really. Sort of taking out senior policy advisors in this country, I know for a fact, because one of them told me, for a nice lunch. This is the chief executive, I think, of Roundtree's or some place like that. And then persuading him over lunch to advise the government that we shouldn't have traffic light signals on foods. That's weird, isn't it, how policy gets formed. I mean, we should expect it, really. So there have been successfully opposed as a form of regulation, and responsibility deals and calorie counts have been introduced instead. So responsibility deals are voluntary. I think calorie counts in many outlets are now compulsory, aren't they? They're compulsory in fast food outlets, I think. But it's been shown, I think, in the evidence that calorie counts are really not very effective at targeting or at getting to the people that you really want to get at, right? Which tends to be relatively poor populations, relatively uneducated, and they're relatively obese. Right? Doesn't really get to those. A lot of people don't even know how many calories are supposed to be consuming a day, right? Probably quite effective in getting people like you to observe calorie counts, but not so effective at the people that you're really trying to address if you are trying to address the obesity problem, right? Behavioural economics suggests that these traffic lights might be more effective. They're very simple signals. It's a red, an amber, a green. Gives you a reference point. Amber might be your reference point. Therefore, red would be perceived by you to be a loss. You'd steer away more than you do now away from the reds. Be attracted to the greens. There'd be gains. Right? Give you a very clear reference point. It suggests, in theory, that these traffic lights might be more effective. And guess what? From the evidence, they are. They are quite effective. It's the most effective form of food labelling, in fact. So, my final two words. Behavioural economics should not be used as a justification for not regulating. I've seen this time and time again in conferences where people, and at meetings more than, I don't so much go to conferences anymore, but seminars and meetings, where people explicitly say that behavioural economics has nothing to do with regulation. It's just not true, as far as I can see it. Right? And the budging industry, if you're bothered about the major problems facing society, if you really want to try to address these problems, right, if you're not just playing ideology or whatever, like, or hiding behind smoke screens, it seems to me that budging industry may be more effective than trying to nudge the citizenry. Okay.
Tesco's the last multiple retailers standing outside the
It's going to adopt it, is it?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, so they've been pushed through in that direction. Okay, good. Are they the last ones?
Yeah.
Okay, so they're all doing it now.
Are they natural budge?
Once you've got Tesco,
you're in. I don't know. I think that might have been a bit of a budge, wasn't it? All right, I think everybody's starting to move, which I can sort of sense that that's an indication of restlessness and desire to leave this room. Right. So, thank you.